Hey y'all, how's it going? I'm Scott. This is my show, Scott Horde Show. Whoa, my mic's all hot. What happened? Oh, I see. Something happened here. Oh boy. Sorry about that. Check me now. How's that? Oh, now I turned this down too far. All right. Hey, it's my show. I'm Scott Horton, and the website is scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,500 of them now, going back to 2003. Almost all anti-war stuff. I guess in the early days, a little bit broader interest, but, you know, the war and the police state and stuff. Anyway, scotthorton.org for all of that, and follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. If you want to hang out in the chat room during the show, it's a great place to hang out during the show. It's scotthorton.org/chat. And it's also an IRC Freenode chat room. So if you're an IRC Freenode type person, then you know what that means better than I do. It's just hashtag Scott Horton Show. So there you go. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. That's what the show is about. Today on the show, Peter Hart and Robert Pape. Peter Hart is going to talk about Gary Webb and CIA cocaine trafficking and mainstream journalism about it, the new movie, Kill the Messenger, about Gary Webb, which, have you guys seen that yet? I haven't seen it. I saw the trailer and it looked great. I don't think it's on the Pirate Bay yet. But anyway, so Peter Hart's going to be on to set us straight about all that. And Robert A. Pape, now, he's an interesting guy. His original big thing, I think, was the study of the uselessness of air power in deciding military conflicts, or certainly, you know, military power alone, I guess, is what I mean to say. Anyway, then he also started studying the causes of suicide terrorism. And I know it's been going on for 10 years now that he's been explaining his findings, 9 years or something. But anyway, so we're going to hear from him today to remind us what the hell is going on with this whole terror war and what all it has to do with the empire and with radical Islam and all of that. His books are Dying to Win and Cutting the Fuse. Dying to Win, the Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism. So there's that. Let's see. And then I got a ton of news to talk about, including, of course, the war in Iraq and Syria, etc., etc. And it's Friday, so hopefully we should have some time. I'd like to take some phone calls from you guys and see what you think about some things. When is Whitehead supposed to be on? I'm falling down on the job here, guys. Is Whitehead on today, too? I better check my email. You know, might be better if I did my show at night. The problem is it's so interview heavy, and especially a lot of times I talk to people over there in Europe and further east than that. And if I did a show at night, it would be way the middle of the night there. But not, you know, it'd have to be really late here to already be morning there, and then I'm completely cutting out all of my American interviewees too, and so. But my brain, it just doesn't work right in the morning. I have a deal to interview these guys. Oh, crap. Now I'm still double booked. I'm triple booked. I can't screw over Peter Hart again. So now I gotta email back Whitehead's. Is it his wife, I guess? I'll do that at the commercial. See, I booked three different guests for 1 o'clock. Well, no, I didn't. I did two for 1:30, then I moved one to one, and then I got another for one. So, same damn difference. Boy. But yeah, I sure hope to get John Whitehead on, because he's got some great stuff, too. I really need, like, a secretary or a intern or a something. All right. One more bit of housekeeping before I get on to the news here, and that is a big thank you to the Young Americans for Liberty at Baylor University up in Waco, who had me give a little talk last night about the war. And, you know, it's the same shtick I always try to do. This is all Bush's fault. It's all what Osama wanted. And then Obama made it even worse. And so now we should stay out. That's my shtick. You're going to hear it again today anyway. Maybe that's why you tuned in here. Wasn't my very best rendition of that shtick. Not to, you know, diminish it. I'm only diminishing the me part, not the importance of what I was trying to say. But anyway, I think they got the point. Yeah. I hope nobody recorded it. It wasn't good enough to replay for you or anything. But they're a great group of young libertarians up there at Baylor. And they had me talk all about the war. And then they asked me about Waco, too. And so, because they're up there in Waco. So they asked me, you know, about the massacre of the Branch Davidians. So I got to talk a little bit about that. And, you know, I don't know. Anyway, they seemed receptive. The most important thing that I have to say about Waco, I say to everybody about Waco, and that is watch Mike McNulty's movies. Watch Waco, The Rules of Engagement, and watch Waco, A New Revelation. Watch those films. And then I guess the next most important thing about that to point out is that they lied the whole time. You know, these guys I was talking to last night at this college, they were not even born yet, or they were a year old or something when this thing happened back in 1993, right? They're just tiny babies if they even existed at all. And so for them, it's sort of ancient history. But for me, it's like it happened yesterday. And the most important lesson, you hear me say it all the time, the most important lesson to me there was that the American people wanted the government to kill the Branch Davidians. I think this is the same with, as Charles Goyette likes to say, he almost stands alone in this, really, in saying this about the Iraq War. This is why nobody got in trouble for lying us into war. The American people didn't care if it was true or not. The American people in majority, more than 150 million of them, wanted more Arabs dead, wanted more revenge. As Thomas Friedman says, it could have been from Baghdad to Basra. And that's where they went, actually. It's could have from Baghdad to Basra, where virtually everyone's a Shia, and nobody's on the side of bin Laden. Nobody. But whatever, let's just kill them. Let's just kill, and can be defined as broadly as you can imagine. Anybody east of Israel, let's just kill some. And that was the American people's consensus. It wasn't just that George Bush lied his ass off to you. I don't know, you, maybe you. But many, many, many Americans, they wanted to believe a bunch of lies. They weren't happy. It's straight out of Star Wars. Dantooine is too remote for an effective demonstration. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to, just like Robert Perry wrote, Iraq was Bush's Alderaan, to prove the point about what happens if you cross the empire. And the American people were behind that. They didn't care if Saddam was friends with Osama. They didn't care if Saddam was making weapons of mass destruction. They just didn't want the war to be over yet. And there wasn't enough rubble to bounce in Afghanistan. It would take years of occupation to provoke the Taliban back into existence. To provoke public support enough to support them in their re-rise. And it's the very same thing with the Branch Davidians. That's why no one got in trouble for murdering the Branch Davidians. The American people wanted them to be murdered. I told the story before, man. I didn't tell this part of the story last night to the kids, but it's true. I was sacking groceries at the time. And all of the moms of Northwest Austin wanted to go in there and get that Koresh. Go in there and get him and end it, they said. And they were happy when the government did end it by killing him. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right. Well, you know, I don't know, man. I'm very opinionated, but maybe I'm just not cut out for broadcasting because I just can't keep what I want to say within the confines of the goddamn segments I got here before the commercial comes and the music's over and I got to stop talking. The point about the suburban housewives of Northwest Austin wanted to see the Branch Davidians murdered is, well, if you're a Christian, the point is mankind's fallen. If you're not, then hey, we're all a bunch of goddamn monkeys, and so what do you expect from a bunch of female monkeys except them screeching and pointing at the ones that they want killed? They're monkeys, after all. That's what I believe. And, well, I've seen them screeching. And the thing of it is, it's just that easy. Now, most of these ladies, they're nice ladies on the average day. But boy, give them a chance to express some, you know, bloodlust and will to power and violence vicariously and through official institutions. And holy crap, they make Bill Clinton, the guy that actually finally sent the Delta Force there to murder the Branch Davidians all to death with fire and machine guns, look calm and patient and reasonable. I'm trying to watch One Life to Live. So take 86 lives. So I'm going to have my TV show back, they all wailed. And it's the same thing for the Iraq War. Charles Goyette is right. So many of the American people, not just rank and file Republicans. Tens and tens and tens and tens of millions, better probably than 100 million people. They wanted an Iraq War. They loved the Iraq War. Hell, the best the liberals could come up with as an argument against it at the time was, we'll give the UN inspectors more time. We agree with you. We're sure that the weapons are there. Just give the inspectors more time to find them, and then you'll be able to say, aha, and then you start the war then. Huh? Oh, because then you can go to the United Nations and get a second resolution. Because aggressive war is always wrong unless you can get France and Russia to agree to it. And France and Russia say it's okay. This is the liberals' opinion, 2003. As long as France and Russia say it's all right, then it's perfectly fine to launch an aggressive war in Iraq. Everybody knows that. That was the best anti-war argument that they had. Because they like war. They're just mad George Bush was doing it. If only Bill Clinton had been in the political position to go and liberate the Iraqi people and save them from their tyrant, the way he saved the Kosovar Albanians. They would have been for it. And anyway, so that's the problem, man, is the bloodlust. The American people got it. And they got it real bad. And they're just, well, and this goes for everybody. I don't know. I don't know. I've only lived in America. I can't really condemn populations of other countries. But the credulity that Americans express toward the most ridiculous and obvious lies, as long as they come from these official organs and institutions, it's amazing to me. Especially when everybody knows better, right? Everybody hates lawyers. Everybody's at least afraid of the cops if they're not brave enough to actually just go ahead and admit that they hate their guts. But never mind the cops. The whole government is run by lawyers. The whole Congress, all lawyers. And if they're businessmen, they're all crony capitalist types. Not free marketeers. They're all somebody with a fat government contract and a fat government regulation to keep their competition out and down. That's who runs our government. And everybody knows that. And everybody hates them. Oh, but you know, if they start accusing people as a pretext to explode them all to death, well, then that's when we start listening because, geez, they wouldn't lie about something like that other than the last 900 examples I can think of. Other than every time they open their mouths coming up with an excuse to kill somebody. It's never true. Hell, they didn't need to lie you into Libya. You didn't even care. But they lied you into Libya. Gaddafi's going to kill 100,000 people tomorrow if we don't stop him. Yeah. They didn't need to lie you into saving the Yazidis on Mount Sinjar back a couple of months ago. At the beginning of July. Halfway through July. Oh, look, everybody. 40,000 Yazidis are stranded on Mount Sinjar. And at the base of the mountain is all Islamic State guys. And they're going to kill them all. It'll be a total genocide. America must stand to help the innocent. And yeah, too bad Saddam and Uday and Qusay weren't there. They used to have the job of protecting the Yazidis until George W. Bush fired them. They're pretty good at it, too. What's left of the Yazidis, some of them were on Mount Sinjar, about 5 or 10,000 of them, but they wanted to be there. They didn't want to leave. And the ones who wanted to leave, they had already left with the help of the PKK communist Kurdish militia that didn't ask for American help to evacuate them out of there. And the mountain wasn't surrounded by the Islamic State. And on CNN, the military wasn't even shy about admitting it. I mean, you talk about your, you know, Gulf of Tonkin cover-up for 15 years. Barbara Starr, official embedded military spokesperson at CNN, announced that, yeah, it was funny. When the special forces got there, there were hardly any Yazidis left. And the ones who were there wanted to stay, and there was no evacuation. Jason Ditz was mocking these guys at antiwar.com. Weeks later, quoting a Marine general, saying, yeah, you know, if there had been people there for us to rescue, then that would have been one of the greatest operations in the history of the Marines. Yeah, if only it had been not a lie, then you would have had something to do. And then that would have been really great. Must be pretty easy to be a Pentagon reporter these days. And then they lied to you about the whole Khorasan group, too. They could have said, listen, there's an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria that's really more of a threat to us than the Islamic State is, because their entire argument is that they've got to attack the Americans. That's what Al-Qaeda has always been about. Attack the far enemy. Whereas the Islamic State, by definition, has more parochial concerns. Not that they aren't bad guys, but here, at the same time they're bombing the Islamic State, they hit al-Nusra a little. But they didn't want to call him al-Nusra because they didn't want to alienate America's moderate jihadist allies by bombing their friends al-Nusra. So they called him the Khorasan group and bombed him anyway. One, how the hell is that supposed to convince the locals who like al-Nusra into thinking, oh, it was just the Khorasan group that they bombed, huh? Well, they all came out and protested against it. They are all mad as hell. Al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda in Syria, has massive popular support among those that America's trying to recruit to our cause. Fighting Assad and ISIS at the same time. But really, they just needed a new name for something to scare your mom. Al-Qaeda in Syria, I thought we were backing those guys the last 3 years. You know, de facto, sort of, kind of, by arming up people who end up handing over all their guns to them eventually and that kind of thing. They're the bad guys now, and that's why we got to start bombing Syria because of al-Nusra, who really, for an al-Qaeda group loyal to Zawahiri, they really haven't focused on the United States at all. They focused on Assad. Wow, Khorasan coming for me. I guess we better start another war. Anyway, that's the lesson of Waco. Stop believing them.
Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first, and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org, or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Joining me again on the line is John W. Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute. That's rutherford.org. And he writes great things opposing the police state. He wrote a book called A Government of Wolves. And he's got another new article here, Hollow Justice and Courts of Order in an Age of Government-Sanctioned Tyranny. We're running it today on antiwar.com. And a very important angle on the police state, and that is the so-called third branch, the independent branch of government that has the right to tell the rest no, supposedly. And it's apparent complete and total lack of willingness to do so. Welcome back to the show. John, how are you doing?
Hey, thank you, sir. I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me on.
Very happy to have you on. You know, back in the very late 1990s, I was on a local unlicensed community radio station called Free Radio Austin, and they got busted by the feds and had to go to the federal court. And I sat in, luckily I wasn't there at the time that it happened, so I didn't have to go to court, but I was there in the audience watching the proceedings. And it was fun to me to see the federal judge, his name is Sam Sparks, he's the guy here in Austin's district, whatever it is. And it was fun to watch him call the government, as though he wasn't part of it, right? Like he was really part of this tradition where, oh no, he's a judge. It really is separate and distinct from the government. And of course, the more he said it, the more obvious it was that that wasn't true at all. He was going along with whatever they wanted, basically. And anyway, so that's how it really works. But it's also, it's kind of puzzling to me.
Federal judges are appointed by politicians.
Well, sure, yeah, but at the same time, they're appointed for life, and if especially when they talk that way, then, you know, I mean, to be a federal judge, you have to have a good enough understanding of the theory of the law and, like, maybe a little bit of respect for it or whatever. Why not get off telling the government no all day instead of helping the government screw the people all day? If that's where, you know, in other words, in the Madisonian system of things where ambition is supposed to counteract ambition, why doesn't Sam Sparks really screw the feds all day instead of really rubber stamping them all day when they couldn't stop him? And that is the way that he would be exercising his most power and authority, right?
Hey, when I was a young lawyer coming up, I had law professors, judges who worked in the system tell me one thing, basically, if you ever want to be a federal judge, they said, don't have any opinions, don't write anything controversial, don't step outside the line, or you'll never be a federal judge. So the people you see sitting on most of the federal courts, and I've been in and out of the courts for 40 years, they're basically part of a system that, in my opinion, is not there for justice. And I've seen it over and over in the cases that I cite in the numerous articles in my book, A Government of Wolves. They're there basically to keep order. They're not there to promote justice. You're not going to get, very seldom do you get any judges, and especially the federal courts, that I would call would be more liberty-oriented. They're just not that way. They're there basically to make sure that there's no revolt, there's no rebellion. I mean, they uphold, and the Supreme Court in over 90% of the cases upholds the state's position, whether it's police shooting people numerous times in cars and all the kind of cases. Maybe we can talk about a few of them, but it's that way. You have a few judges who step outside the line occasionally, but when they do, they seem to come back in line, especially Supreme Court judges, and rule with the majority the next time it comes around, some kind of crazy case that doesn't make any sense. For example, when the Supreme Court ruled 2 years ago that if a SWAT team arrives at your door, they're at the wrong place, they have no warrant, but they think you might be doing something illegal, they can still crash through your door in an 8-1 decision. This is without a warrant. The Supreme Court upheld that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the kind of cases we're seeing coming down. You would think that would be happening in Nazi Germany or some other totalitarian regime presently operating in the world, but it's happening in America.
Right.
So,
well, and I think that's part of the crisis here is everybody's recognizing it's like We're living now in it's a government of wolves, but it's a nation of John Whiteheads saying, well, wait a minute now. You don't have to be some doctrinaire libertarian to object to this. This goes to the most very basic definition of what it means to live in America that we learn as kindergartners and stuff. We're like, hey, they're supposed to at least pretend they're interested in justice. They're supposed to at least pretend they're interested in fairness. They're, you know, it's not supposed to be a system like this where, you know, like the way I learned it when I was a kid. In America, you're free. Unless you commit a crime and do something wrong to somebody else, the government isn't even interested in you at all, unlike in that evil old Soviet Union and that kind of thing. And so everybody's mom and everybody's sister and everybody's everybody is catching on to this. Whoa, we're really sliding down a slippery slope here.
Well, yeah, but, you know, here's a couple things about the judges, most especially the federal courts. They're about 20 years behind technology and society. It takes them a while to catch up. I'm not saying they're slow readers, but they're not. In fact, I have a few friends that have covered the Supreme Court regularly. They told me, they said, when it comes to cell phones or electronic devices, watch out. Most of the Supreme Court judges, I think only one or two of them actually use the Internet or use cell phones. So you're dealing with technologically illiterate people to begin with. And then you have the mindset that we got to make sure there's no more strange people uprising out there. A Martin Luther King, for example, who was looked down upon by the courts, by the way. So, yeah, I think we have to wake up and realize that when the stuff that we've read about in former regimes and stuff is happening in America right now. In fact, I would go so far as to say that we're moving really into what I would call a regime right now. It's going to be very, very difficult. I mean, the Supreme Court just ruled last year that if you're arrested and you're just a suspect and you're charged with a so-called serious crime, unquote, unquote, they can forcibly take DNA from you. The FBI wants a huge DNA file, and there are a number of reasons I think they want that file. In fact, I'm doing some research on that right now, but I mean, they can forcibly take your DNA now. They can put you down on the floor and take it. They ruled in the Florence case, if you're arrested for a misdemeanor, the police can now strip search you at the police station. This is a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been, Scott, ever strip searched forcibly, but it's one of the most egregious things. You're talking about anal searches and those kind of things. But this has been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. And again, I'm going to go back and say, this is not the old Soviet Union or Nazi Germany. It's the USSA.
Yeah. Well, now, so let me ask you this, because in the last couple of days, I interviewed a professor who talked about the national security state as the permanent government, the real seat of power in America.
I agree with that,
is the executive branch. Right. And then I interviewed Shane Bauer all about the militarization of the police yesterday. And so we talked a little bit, and he's from Mother Jones, you know, but we talked a little bit about the economics of this, where, of course, you know, it's all free money to a local sheriff. He has every interest in spending as much as he can, and you could...
And most of it's, you know, the war on drugs is all aimed at making money. SWAT team raids get federal grants for doing pot raids. Yeah.
Well, now, but so my question, though, is in terms of a larger agenda... And I wonder if you think that there really is some kind of consensus at the more establishment levels that, holy crap, we are so terrified of the American people that we better build a totalitarian police state to keep them all down because they're that afraid of us for whatever reason. I don't know why they would be. Or is it really just the economics of the same old military-industrial complex? If you can sell armored trucks to the Pentagon to sell to the sheriff's departments or whatever it is, then you're going to lobby, you're going to sell as many as you can, and you don't really care who gets killed with them later, right? I mean, it's just every rifle salesman has the same interest in getting the government to give him the contract to create a system of enslavement for us all here. Oh, man, and now
well,
damn music.
I talk to local police who get the so-called FBI alerts. Friends that I know, they don't like them. They're concerned by them, but there's certain segments of the population that are labeled extremists that have to be watched.
I'm sorry. We got to stop and take this break. My fault,
okay,
as always. John Whitehead, Rutherford.org. We'll be right back. Government of Wolves is the book. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com.
They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the back side. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with John W. Whitehead, author of A Government of Wolves. He's at Rutherford.org, the Rutherford Institute. This article is Hollow Justice and Courts of Order. And we're going to get back. I want you to talk about all these decisions as you do in this article that blow people's mind and all of that kind of thing. But where we left off at the break, we were talking, you know, a kind of bigger picture, all the militarization, throw in all the court rulings, rubber stamping it all if you want. It's the same kind of thing. And so I was asking about whether there's an agenda here. I mean, you keep talking about Nazi Germany, but in Nazi Germany, you knew what happened there. The Nazis took over, and there are a bunch of fanatical, psychopathic murderers with their Gestapo running around, killing whoever they wanted, and declaring that freedom is not workable. You're going to do what the Führer says, and all this kind of crap. But here in America, somehow they seem to be accomplishing the same agenda in not so slow motion here without too much of an outcry. But with seeming consensus on elite, you know, power type levels. So I guess I was, you know, hoping you could explain what you think is really behind it.
Well, I think what I see, and I say it in my book and other places, I think there's some paranoia, what I call up top in the government. The Department of Homeland Security, a year and a half ago, when they contracted to buy from the ATK Corporation 1.6 billion hollow point bullets. They didn't buy them up off the market. When I first raised the issue with some people, I said, oh, they're just buying up bullets. I said, oh, no, no, no. They actually had them made specially for their agents. The Social Security Administration purchased almost 200,000 hollow point bullets to be distributed to 41 locations across America. Hollow point bullets explode on contact. They tear your arm off. That's what Martin Luther King was shot in the head with. Kennedy, you go down. John Lennon actually was shot with four hollow point bullets at his chest. They explode on contact. They're meant to kill and maim. So why would the government be doing that? I mean, I think there's some paranoia. And again, I talk to local police chiefs in different parts of the country that are friends of mine. They don't like the FBI alerts they get where certain segments of the population are labeled extremists. In 2009, this Department of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, under Obama, issued two memos, right-wing extremism and left-wing extremism, where they listed what they considered to be potential terrorists. It was PETA groups on the left and animal rights groups. On the right, it was returning veterans or anybody that opposed government. So it's not a conspiracy theory. They've already labeled who they think mm-hmm. needs to be targeted. It's anybody that's basically going to get out there on the streets. The Occupy movement, 2011, extremists. And what happened to them? Well, folks, all you got to do is read a few articles on the internet. They got their heads beat in. So there is a reaction out there, and when you use the word Nazi, there's a couple people that I quote in my book, A Government of Wolves, they call it friendly fascism. I think the government's just learned how to do it better now, softer, better father figures in government, which is a key element in those kind of deals. You know, Obama is a nice, smiling father figure. Mm.
Well, and they mostly are picking on people.
The more Madison Avenue
voice.
It is, the more people step in line and go, oh, let's get rid of the rebel rousers. Let's get rid of the troublemakers. But I go back and look at my heroes of the past, Martin Luther King and people like that. Wow, were they rebel rousers? And I remember as a young guy reading the same kind of stuff about them, troublemakers. Let's get rid of them. Let's get this guy in jail somewhere. The FBI actually collected, 17,000 pages of information on Martin Luther King on how to stop his protests. Mm-hmm. So It's not a conspiracy or any of that kind of stuff. They've been doing it for years. Mm-hmm. So we just know more about it now, we should know more about
it. And we hear about, you know, from the way that they talk where, and this goes for, you know, local sheriff's deputies quoted here and there to people at the highest levels of power, they consider really any marginal politics, and it's a really wide margin because it's a very narrow set of official you know, acceptable opinion. Any politics outside of that, especially anybody trying to organize outside of Republican and Democratic circles,
yeah,
is they consider
right.
that to be near terrorism. They'll call it soft terrorism, or you know,
they
might try
it
to come up with some qualifier.
But,
you know, yeah, extremism.
They call
sure,
it extremists.
Yeah.
And when I read those two memos, and people, you should go read those. Right-wing extremism and left-wing extremism, the words extremist and terrorist were used in the same sentence sometimes. Mm-hmm. So after I read the memos, I wrote a commentary and put it out and said, hey, I'm a terrorist after reading that, just because I oppose government, well, a lot of governmental policies that deny freedom. So that's the lay of the land. You get back to the courts, the
right.
courts are upholding that. When I see Obama at that last State of the Union address and I saw Supreme Court justices around him like he was a rock star, I went, wait a minute, that's not the way it's supposed to work. They're supposed to balance out the president, the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be worshiping him. I mean, they shouldn't be worshiping Congress. They're there for the people. But here, and again, I've advocated this, the Supreme Court judges, they shouldn't be appointed for life. I disagree with that. Eight to 10 years on the Supreme Court's enough. Give us new people. Give us young people. I mean, the average age of a Supreme Court justice now is like 70 years old. I mean, and again, I go back, there's a lot of young folks in America that need to be represented. They want freedom. And I don't think what we're seeing in the courts, and I've been in and out of the courts, I've been at the Supreme Court with cases arguing, you're dealing with very stodgy people who are part of the system. You're not dealing with radicals of any sort. There have been a few radical Supreme Court judges over the year, and I quote Justice Douglas. He was more radical, but we don't have anybody like that on the Supreme Court right now.
Yeah, it seems like, especially when you have this giant list of all the things that they're rubber stamping, and then as you point out, and this is all important. I don't know if many people understand this really, but the Supreme Court's refusal to hear a case is the same as just you know, agreeing with the lower court and whatever it said. But
it seems
like they've gone so far that now it would take Congress to come and pass new laws, basically outlawing the court from claiming jurisdiction on these issues, and just saying, actually, Supreme Court, you can't legalize these things, and so all these decisions are null and void. So in other words, Ron Paul would have to be the president and the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader.
You're right. Don't bet on Congress to do anything. They're in hip hoc, and we all know that. I mean, I've written on that, and that's documented. There's the lobbyists basically control Congress. The corporate entities do. But when the Supreme Court in 2014, not here too long ago, did not refuse to hear the NDAA appeal case,
right,
where the military can arrive and take you away, they upheld the Korematsu decision, essentially, which created concentration camps in America in the 1940s. And by the way, Justice Scalia, just in a speech he gave about 2 or 3 weeks ago, said he thought you could have the concentration camps again. He just said, sure, I think it will happen probably in times of crisis. This is a Supreme Court judge. He said it a couple mm-hmm. weeks ago in a speech.
Sure. Even though, you know, especially for the young, maybe not too familiar with the argument or whatever, all of the rest of American society has condemned that horrible, awful mistake, like that time they killed all the Indians kind of a thing that should have
yeah.
never happened, the mass imprisonment of Japanese Americans in World War II. But to Scalia, hey, there is no limit on executive power when it comes to the very worst things that government could do to you. Definitely not.
Yeah, so we don't... What's happened, I think, is free-thinking people, by the time they go through the hearing process to become a federal judge, they're weeded out. Again, I was told very clearly, don't write anything controversial. You'll never be a judge. So they're quiet. They fall in line. They get a great job. I mean, imagine being a Supreme Court judge where you are ribbing around limos, airplanes. You've got all the things you want in the world. And to give you an idea of a case that we had, and this is probably one of the most shocking cases, it's a guy named Harold Hodge. We represented him, and we're still in court over this case. He stood out in front of the Supreme Court a couple years ago on a January day. There was no one out there. It was snowing. He held a sign around his neck which said, "The police brutalize African Americans and Hispanics in America." He was quickly arrested for not moving. He was all by himself right in front of the Supreme Court. He wasn't blocking the doors or anything. We filed a case in his behalf. The federal judge ruled that the law, it's a congressional law saying you can't be on the Supreme Court plaza demonstrating or portraying a message. The judge ruled that it was repugnant to the Constitution. 2 days later, the Justice Court, the Roberts Court, issued its own administrative rule prohibiting. It was even more restrictive. Anybody being out there on that plaza with a message.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about free speech. I mean, that means you could not walk out, you, Scott, could not walk out in front of the Supreme Court and turn and go, this court sucks.
Yeah. Well, and you're saying
it doesn't do a good job.
He didn't just do that, but he didn't just do that, but he did that after a lower court had tried to do the right thing for a minute.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Basically, the Roberts Court overruled. And here's the thing. We're still in the courts with that case. We're appealing it. We got to go up to that court now.
Yeah.
What kind of court issues something like that knowing there may have to hear this case?
Yeah. Yeah, the Federalist Society. They're all the wrong parts of that and none of the right, it seems to me, when you look at Alito and Roberts and these guys. They might as well all be David Addington and Dick Cheney up there. For their conservatism is conserve executive power at all costs. That's all they care
about. Keep order.
Yeah. All right. Hey, that's John Whitehead at Rutherford.org. Thanks very much, John.
Hey, thank you, sir.
Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton's Show. Our next guest is Peter Hart from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. That's F-A-I-R, fair.org. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Peter?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing real good. Been a while, and so happy to have you on, and especially about this. Now, I've got a problem with server changeovers and misplaced audio folders, so you cannot listen to my Gary Webb interview at scotthorton.org, but you can find it on YouTube. So there you go. Just put in my name and Gary Webb, and you can hear my interview of him from January 2004 about his book, Dark Alliance, the follow-up to his series in the San Jose Mercury News. I'm reminded more and more, and I know you're older than me, so sorry, Peter, but I'm old. And there are a lot of people who are grown adults who are interested in what's going on in the world who were not paying attention because they were toddlers at the time that Gary Webb came out with his stuff and created such controversy back then in the mid-1990s. So I will ask you, sir, to please give us and I understand your role in this. So you give us your thumbnail sketch of the story that he reported and why it was so important. Then we can talk all about the saga of Gary and his fight with the media, which is really your dog in this.
Yeah, it's – well, thanks for reminding me that I'm old, because I do remember all of this happening more or less in real time. And the important thing to remind people who are a little bit younger is that this story was the first time that the Internet actually spread a journalistic product that you couldn't go out and buy a copy of the Mercury News around the country. You could, on your creaky dial-up, read this story, and it spread because people could go read it for themselves and because, as you mentioned, Gary Webb doing a lot of interviews, he did a lot of talk radio, particularly black talk radio in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, to try to get some attention to this story. And I think that's the first thing you have to say about him is that he's not a journalist who would report a story and then say, it's not my business to get it out there or to get people involved. He was very clear. He wanted people to read it. He wanted people to do something about it. The story that he reported, when you hear him tell it, it kind of piggybacked on things that he had read in the papers about a decade earlier, written by a guy named Bob Perry at the Associated Press, or co-written by Bob Perry. Bob Perry was writing about the links between the Contras, that was the CIA's army that was waging a terrorist campaign in Nicaragua to try to unseat the government that we didn't like there, their links to the drug trade. And the piece of it that Gary Webb came along and I think really fleshed out was that he met the dealers themselves and linked these guys who were raising money for the CIA's army in another country via the drug trade. They were able to supply one dealer in particular in California, a guy named Freeway Rick Ross, with cheap cocaine that Ross turned into crack. So the story linked a foreign policy adventure from the 1980s to the very real impact that it had and the drug war that people were living with in the 80s and into the 90s. That was the story that Webb told. There were a lot of details and I think a lot of fascinating elements. He did not do certain things. He did not say the CIA was running this. He did not say the CIA was in the crack business. But what he did, if you go back and read his pieces, you can read them at the Narco News website. It's one of the few places, I think, where they still all exist in their original form. You can see that you have a certain group of dealers who are enjoying some kind of legal status that seems to keep them out of trouble with LAPD and DEA. A lot of lawyers, public defenders saying, you know, we always found it curious that Ross and a couple of these other guys never got rolled up like other people. You know, Webb started reporting on the drug war asset forfeiture, where, you know, the government could call someone a drug dealer and start reining in their personal, their private property, even if the evidence wasn't particularly strong. That was where he got into this business. And, you know, Freeway Rick was one of those people that, for whatever reason, he was never suffering the same kind of consequences as other dealers, even though he was this kingpin of the cocaine trade. So that's the story he wrote. And, you know, I had to go through, like, you know, you have a Webb interview that people can go watch on YouTube. I had to dig up the old cassettes from the interviews we did with him in real time. And Gary was always very careful about what they knew and what they didn't know. And it would only come out later that if there's any criticism of the series at all, it's that the scandal turned out to be a lot bigger than Dark Alliance portrayed it. But that, I think, is, you know, in a nutshell, that was the story that he told. And, you know, to people who are younger than this, they might look at it and go, well, the CIA's in business with some people who are doing some things, huh? That doesn't sound that exciting. But at the time, it caused a massive overreaction from government officials, certainly from the CIA, and then, of course, from other people in the media who decided that instead of trying to nail down this story, they were going to go after Gary Webb.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that part of the story is almost unbelievable. I mean, I remember at the time seeing just the little one square column inch in the Austin American Statesman that, yeah, remember that guy Gary Webb that wrote that thing about the CIA and the cocaine? Well, he's been demoted to the celebrity beat at the San Jose Mercury News. And I remember thinking, like, it was just, it was too horrible to be true. It was too obvious for that to be the real ending to this. Really? That's what you're going to do to this guy is just completely throw him under the bus? And then that's what they did. Every other reporter attacked him and even his own bosses. And correct me if I'm wrong about this, but isn't it the case, Peter, that the most overstated anything in the entire article was some graphic that he didn't even write? It was the editors who put that there, the very same editors who were the ones who said, yeah, you know, he did get a little hyperbolic there, but it was them.
Yeah, you know, and this is important when we talk about how the media went after Webb. What did they pick on? Well, the graphic that a designer chose to accompany the piece online was a crack pipe and the CIA logo. Now, you can make arguments about why that's inappropriate or whatever, but that was the I think the biggest thing they attacked at first. You also, though, had journalists who objected to the idea that the Contras were the CIA's army, which was the way Webb referred to them a couple of times in the pieces and the series. And you know, there's nothing controversial about that at all. This was a loosely affiliated group of exiles and opponents of the Sandinista government. The CIA grouped them all together were finding ways to fund this operation, and so this is what we knew as the Contras. So this was absolutely the CIA's army, no doubt about it. You could call them the CIA's terror squad if you wanted to, but this was the caliber of criticism that we saw from the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. The first reaction to Gary Webb's stories were silence. You know, and Fair, along with some others, were protesting at the time, saying, you know, other newspapers need to get on board here and try to investigate this. And, you know, that's the only time anything becomes a scandal in American politics, if the rest of the press steps up, and they were ignoring it. Well, they went from ignoring it to trying to go after the guy who reported it. And the criticisms that were in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times rang hollow, but they did the dirty work in the sense that his own newspaper, the People, Jerry Seppos, the editor of the paper at the time, they got cold feet, and they, I think, felt enormous pressure. You know, the big guys are after us. The New York Times is writing about this. The Washington Post, Howard Kurtz is talking about Gary Webb as if he's a conspiracy theorist, saying, you know, Oliver Stone, check your voicemail. This was the caliber of analysis, you know. And I think it's important that you look back at that and you say, well, where did these people end up? You know, the people who went after Webb instead of going after the real story, none of them paid a price. Gary Webb did. So if you're looking for a lesson in this, it's almost, as you say, you know, it's almost too perfect that here's a guy, writes an explosive story, makes the CIA look bad, makes the American government look bad, and, you know, what's the consequence?
Marginalize him right into damn grave. Journalism. All right, now, hold on. I'm sorry. I had to sum up quick because we got to take this break. We'll be right back with Peter Hart from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. About the great Gary Webb. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Peter Hart. He's at FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And he's got an article here, a worthless and whiny attack on a genuine journalistic hero. And this is a great refutation of Jeff Lean at the Washington Post, who decided that on the occasion of the new movie Kill the Messenger, about Gary Webb, this great reporter from the San Jose Mercury News, who broke the story, or an important part of the story, of CIA cooperation with cocaine run and Contras back in the 1980s. He is basically recreating that same media witch hunt that they went on against Gary back then, and piling on again now. And so here, Peter Hart's taking him apart. So now, let's get to that, because that gets right to the heart of things anyway. What exactly is it that Jeff Lean is accusing Gary Webb of doing wrong here? Because I read the thing, and it seemed like he somewhat acknowledged that the conclusions were correct.
Yeah, it's a confused piece, but the point of it, as the Jump headline said, why Gary Webb was no journalistic hero, the point is to say that this movie that's out right now that presents Webb as a guy who told the truth but the big media went after him was, as Lean put it, pure fiction. The problem is that he doesn't know what Webb reported, or he just doesn't care, and he wants to mislead people or lie about it in order to make his point. Gets right into it. He says, you know, Webb's story made the extraordinary claim that the Central Intelligence Agency was responsible for the crack cocaine epidemic in America. Now, if you go back to Dark Alliance, that is not what Gary Webb reported. So, again, this is, you know, in 2014, we're reliving 1996 and 1997, where people at elite establishment media outlets put words in Gary Webb's mouth and then say, of course, this is false. Once you misstate the premise of somebody's reporting to say that they didn't get it right, it's hard to know, you know, what else you're going to write. But he goes further and he says, you know, when Webb finally wrote the book version of Dark Alliance, he tried to distance himself from these claims. I never believed and I never wrote that there was a grand CIA conspiracy. the idea Lean is trying to tell you is that, you know, Webb walked back what he reported. Again, that's absolutely false. He actually cites the guy who wrote the Kill the Messenger book, a reporter in Orange County, California, who did really great work tracking down some of the people who wrote their hit pieces on Gary Webb. And he brings him in to sort of make his point for him. He says, you know, there were some flaws, there were some hyperbole in the piece. And the interesting thing about that is that this is from an LA Times article where if you go and read that LA Times article by Nick Hsiao, his point is that Gary Webb got this story right and the rest of the media got it wrong. So somebody who says Gary Webb was wrong is citing someone who says Gary Webb got it right to make his point. This is the caliber of criticism that's going on. You know, some of the reactions to Kill the Messenger have been kind of confused. There's this New York Times story. The big headline says, "Resurrecting a Disgraced Reporter." And then the sub-headline says, "Kill the Messenger recalls a reporter wrongly disgraced." They don't even know what's up and what's down anymore. And I think part of the problem is that after Dark Alliance, the CIA launched this Inspector General investigation. You know, whatever you want to say about the CIA investigating itself, let's just take that with a grain of salt. But they came back, and if you read the conclusions clearly enough, they said Gary Webb was correct about some of these things. We did not have operational control over this crack ring, of course, but the CIA looked the other way, or worse, knowing that there was drug running going on to send money to the Contras. That is what the Gary Webb story was in the first place. Okay.
Well, yeah, yeah,
and
exactly.
you can argue about how much money, the crack trade was sending to Nicaragua. You know, some of the deniers say like, well, it was $50,000 and Webb says it was millions. The CIA is never going to admit that kind of stuff. But on the essential point, the CIA essentially agreed with Dark Alliance, and that's the thing that I think is hard for these people to grapple with right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and now, have you read the book too? I admit it was 10 years ago when I did.
Yeah.
But now, so in the book, there's just no question about any of this. If people want to cry about that he overstated the articles in the newspaper, then they must all, you know, have dropped dead of heart attacks when they read the book where he talks about how Freeway Rick had such a supply of cocaine that it became in his interest to cut a deal with virtually every cocaine dealer in L.A. north of the 10-2. And, hey, guys, you know, whatever it is you're paying, let's not fight. I can undercut your guy. And he ran, you know, what was essentially a gigantic, you know, tens of millions of dollar a year business. They call him the Walmart of crack and cocaine and whatever. He stopped gang wars by being the common supplier of different gangs at different times and stuff like this. I mean, if you read the book, if anything in the book is true, then the article just pales in comparison. It only is just beginning to, kind of identify the extent of, the effect that this particular supply of cocaine had on South Central Los Angeles in that era, the rise of the Crips and the Bloods and their gang war.
Well, you know what the book is? If you listen to Gary Webb speak in 96, he was saying, you know, we've got a lot more stories. This is the beginning of a series. We have more to report. His paper backed out of that idea. The book is, I think, represents Webb's full account, you know, the things he wanted to continue writing for the Mercury News that he couldn't. So that's why I think the book expands on some of this. You have to look at the original reporting, the original series, as the beginning of that story. The rest of it is the story that Gary Webb could not report because his newspaper bailed on him and the rest of the media attacked him.
Yeah.
That's why I think you see a more expansive view of all of this. But still, you know, you look at it, and I think it's an extraordinarily careful work that does not step into the areas that he's accused of, even though, you know, and I remember at the time, the criticism of Webb's story was that, you know, there's a lot of history of the CIA being involved in the drug trade, that if that was in your newspaper article, it really would have bolstered the idea. It wouldn't seem so unusual for the CIA to be running drugs. And he agreed. He said, you know, of course, there's a lot of history that I wish we could have gotten in there. So if anything, there was criticism of Webb's reporting when it appeared in the Mercury News. If anything, it was, this could have been gone further than it did. And I think that, you know, when you look at the book, you look at the reports that came out afterwards, The main point you can make about Gary Webb is that the story got bigger and more explosive. And that's when the elite media walked away. It's the same thing that happened with Bob Perry's stories, you know, that came 10 years earlier. There was a very frightening story being told to elite reporters, people who I think self-identify with government officials and government agencies. And that story was that our government is doing something fundamentally unconscionable, and I don't know how to report this out. You know, that's why, you know, you look at this Washington Post, this attack on Webb, and, you know, the guy's point is that, you know, if you make an extraordinary claim, it requires extraordinary proof. Well, somebody like that is waiting for an invoice that's marked CIA, and it's addressed to a drug dealer, and it's got a price for the cocaine on it. That's never going to happen. What Gary Webb reported was what a good investigative journalist does, which is to show you the links
between
all these things. On the
other hand, I mean, maybe this is along the same lines of what you mean, but when you talk about the extent of the cover that was provided to these guys by the federal government to prevent the LAPD from cracking down on them, I mean, that's all you need to know right there. I mean,
the CIA went and got retrieved money for one of the drug dealers because he got busted.
And that's the part
that
they concede in the CIA
series,
report.
And you thought, right. No way. The CIA admitted that that was what they did, right, in their own report. So, come on.
Yep. All right. And now, I'm sorry, we're over time, but for people who aren't familiar, at least, you know, people listening to the recording later of this, we have to give a word to the fact that, in case, you know, people don't know about this, and hell, it's worth bringing up anyway, they ran this guy into his grave. They ruined his life, they being the CIA and all of their media lapdogs, which is 99% of them. They ruined this guy's life, ruined his career, and then his life, and then he took his own life.
That's it, yeah. You know, he ended up being transferred to a bureau that was something like 90 minutes from his house. You know, we want you to stay away from the stories you were reporting before. He got a job in state government doing investigations for a committee. Ended up at a weekly newspaper in Sacramento for a while, but really was just drummed out of journalism. And in 2004, took his own life. And I think, you know, that's the message. And I think that's why people like Bob Perry are so passionate about this and don't want to let Webb's memory fade, because to them, they see a reporter who did the kind of thing that journalists are supposed to do, and look at what the rest of his quote-unquote profession did to him, and look at what, you know, what cowards he was surrounded by. That is the story of Gary Webb, and, you know, you can read his reporting, and you can let it live on that way, and remind yourself, as a recent piece in the Huffington Post did, actually, that the people who went after Gary Webb are still around. They still have jobs in the mainstream media. They've been
a lot of them helped Liason in a war with Iraq a couple of times now. And
exactly.
Almost,
you know,
into
it's
Iran
the same story
and
over
Syria
and over again.
And, yep. All right. Very same ones. No accountability. And so the very same reporters will get us in the same trouble. Although at least it makes your job easy. You know who's RSS feed to follow. And
I guess so, yeah.
That's right about. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Peter. It's great to have you back on the show. Appreciate it.
Great talking to you.
All right, y'all, that's the great Peter Hart. He's at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and here he is being very fair to the heroic Gary Webb, a worthless and whiny attack on a genuine journalistic hero. Again, fair.org and Robert Pape right after this. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. In the chat room, it's being speculated that I'll be one of the first to go to the camps. I say at least I'll be with all my favorite writers. All right. That joke is actually 10 years old. Our next guest on the show today, our final guest on the show today, is Robert A. Pape. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and he is the author of Dying to Win, The Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, and also the sequel to that is called Cutting the Fuse, and he's at the airport, so it's a little noisy, but that's all right. Welcome back to the show, Bob. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on, Seth.
It's very good to have you back on the show. It's been a long time since we've spoken. And now, so there's a reason I got you on, a particular timely newsworthy reason, and then I got some overall questions about some other stuff, too. But Glenn Greenwald has written the same thing he always writes whenever there's a terrorist attack in the West, and that is that actions have consequences. And only this time, Glenn Greenwald is now world famous and humongous, and so the entire war party is taken out after him, pretending that he is justifying terrorism and apologizing for it. In the words of Jeffrey Goldberg on Twitter, Greenwald says Canada had it coming, which of course is not at all what he said, but I'm sure you're used to being paraphrased incorrectly along those same lines,
yeah,
I think.
I think that it's terribly important that we try to explain the actions of our opponents and our enemies. When we try to explain the causes, the actual causes, as opposed to just name-calling, then it's easy for those who might disagree to say, oh, well, what that explanation is somehow a moral defense. But that's really far from the truth. If we're going to actually undermine and defeat a threat, we need to understand what's causing it. Otherwise, we can easily take actions that make it worse. So it's just simply a mistake for those who disagree on the substance of what causes a threat to blame the other as somehow a moral accomplice. Mm-hmm. This is basically just ugly politics, and it serves no one well, and it doesn't improve our security.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, but here's the thing, though. Value free. Obviously, we all universally condemn anyone killing civilians in, you know, in any context or anything like that. But you still, sir, are basically telling the American people you started it. Not you deserve what happens to you because you started it. Not that it's okay for the other side to attack civilians. No, no, no. But you started it. That's really what you're telling them. And that is quite a tough pill to swallow. No?
It's a tough pill to swallow, but I just gave a talk yesterday to the Chicago FBI. I've given numerous talks to elites in Washington on both sides of the aisle. And the fact of the matter is, when you get the cameras off and we sit down and we talk about the hard facts and the hard evidence, there's growing consensus about what is triggering and causing the threat. It's not like we're in a world where we were 10, 12 years ago, that we are in a data vacuum where we just don't understand what's coming at us. It's true in the general public, it's difficult to have a serious discussion of the facts in the general public, but that's not really the case with the elites behind closed doors. And I think that this is probably most reflected in the strategy that President Obama is pursuing against ISIS. So for over a decade, I and some others have been calling for a strategy to counter the threat of terrorism from the Persian Gulf called offshore balancing, which is to rely on over-the-horizon air, naval, and special forces and empowering local groups to undermine the threat. Well, that is the strategy that Obama has followed. That's the strategy that he articulated in his speech about a month ago, and strategy he's been pursuing against ISIS pretty much from the beginning. It is a strategy that will take several years to have real bite, but it reflects the fact that I think there's growing understanding of the facts of what's really driving the threat.
Right. Now, there's a problem with that, though, and I think you're right about that, that he understands that putting in ground troops will be counterproductive over the long term. On the other hand, it seems like nothing short of ground troops is actually going to get the job done of looking like they're even really degrading the Islamic State, and that would be, I would think, a major step would be driving them out of power in Mosul, which of course would just turn them back into an insurgency anyway. It wouldn't necessarily get rid of them at all. They might turn and run at the first sight of the Marines rather than stand there and fight and turn back into an insurgency. But who other than the Marines can do it? Even with American air power backing them, can the so-called Iraqi army and Shiite militias take Mosul? Probably not, right?
The real local group that matters are the Sunni tribes. It is not going to be the case that we should bet that the Kurds are going to launch a major ground offensive, take large swaths of Sunni territory, because the Sunnis would fight hard for that territory, and then the Kurds would die in significant numbers, and they're not willing to do it. Right. Just as the Shia dominated Iraqi army would not fight and die for Sunni areas. That doesn't mean they won't fight and die for their own areas. The Kurds are going to fight and die for their own areas. The Shia will fight and die for their own areas. But we shouldn't be asking the Kurds or the Shia or the Americans to go and die to take Sunni territory. The groups that care are the Sunni tribes. And the reason that ISIS is a bigger problem today than it was several years ago isn't simply because there's a couple thousand Islamic radicals or terrorists in Iraq. It's because the Sunni tribes decided to ally with ISIS. And they did so because for the last several years, the Shia-backed government in Iraq in particular has been trying to suppress the Sunni tribe. So what Obama has done is put has tried to change the politics of the situation first. That's what he did in June, so that there is a much more inclusive government in Baghdad that's not trying to put their thumb on the Shia, on the Sunni tribes. And now the next step is to start to build real working alliances with the tribes, which we've had in the past. And I think that this is really the way forward, and not just the way forward for Obama, but this is going to be the way forward for a Hillary Clinton administration, for a Republican administration. If we're going to undermine and deal with ISIS, it's going to come through the Sunni.
Yeah. Well, now, I'm not for doing a thing. I prefer complete non-intervention at this point, although I absolutely agree with you that it's the Sunni tribes who own this fight, and it's theirs to win. And as we saw, as you say, in 2006 and 7, the Al-Qaeda and Iraq guys are such jerks. Nobody will accept their rule. It's just not legitimate rule. It never can be. They're a militia, and they're legitimate as a militia in certain circumstances. But, really anything that we do to help the Sunni tribes or to help them ally with the Shia in Baghdad actually would be counterproductive. We ought to just knock it off. But anyway, I do appreciate that this is a lot better than sending in the entire 3rd Infantry Division, the entire Marine Corps, like George Bush did.
To show you how broadly elites understand this, I was just at a public session with General John Abizaid, who used to be the CENTCOM commander. Mm-hmm. And what I'm going to tell you, he said in public, so I'm not revealing a confidence, but he explained to this fairly large audience at the Council on Foreign Relations that he's in no way justifying why ISIS is getting ahead in the Sunni areas, but he wanted them to understand why. And he explained that when ISIS goes into a Sunni area, the first thing they do is get bulldozers out and clear the trash from the streets. The second thing they do is they round up criminals that are stealing. Now, yes, it's true, they're using some brutal methods to punish the criminals, like cutting off a hand if they're stealing. But the fact is, as General Abizaid said, a local village or a local town that is basically facing huge problems because the Shia-backed government in Baghdad refuses to clear up the trash, refuses to deal with crime in the streets. Well, this is what's creating the opportunity for ISIS in the Sunni areas, and he is strongly in agreement that we need to start supporting the Sunni tribes to basically act as the natural alternative to ISIS.
All right, but now here's the thing, though. What about the politics of when this doesn't work as well? Because, you know, I've been talking with Patrick Coburn, who's the best journalist in the whole world on all of this stuff, who's been explaining the slow-motion train wreck with the rise of the Islamic State here for the past few years on the show. And he's talked at length about how they have learned the lesson of Zarqawi and company's failure from 2006 and 7. They've got some very powerful imams and tribal leaders and Ba'athist military officers basically being held hostage right now as, you know, ransom on their power, that no one dare come after their power, or they're going to cut the heads off of these extremely prominent, valuable people to their local communities that they've got. In other words, they're extremely wary of that awakening stab in the back they got last time, and they've really covered their bases pretty well this time, and they're a lot better armed and a lot better financed than before. And they may be the smallest, weakest little state in the world, but they're a hell of a lot bigger than Al-Qaeda in Iraq ever was back when. And so it may not be that easy, but then again, you know, too much American participation with those tribes, again, might just backfire and might drive more people into the hands of the Islamic State. So
you're right.
But then the calendar keeps going by, and there's presidential and other political, you know, politics about how long are we going to let Baghdadi claim Raqqa and Mosul as his capitals like this, you know?
So you're right. If we tried to turn the tribes into our little army that was basically run out of the White House to get them to do our bidding, then that's going to backfire. But that's not what we did the last time we supported the tribes, and it's not what we should be doing now, and it's not the way forward. It's important to remember that in fall 2006, AQI changed its name to the Islamic State of Iraq. That's where the first declaration of the Islamic State of Iraq came from.
Right.
And what happened is that created a natural fissure between ISI and the tribe. And the reason is because that threatens the authority of tribal elders. So the tribes are only supporting this group because there's a bigger threat from the Shia government. Well, how did we deal with this before? We paid the tribes $300 per person a month to just simply do one thing. Don't kill us. They could get guns with that. They could defend themselves from the Shia government. They could defend themselves from the terrorist group. The main thing was they just shouldn't kill us. Well, we need to return to that policy, and we need to return to a long-term commitment to that policy, as opposed to simply having a policy that's there and then we turn it off. And that's really the way forward. It's not to turn the Sunni tribes into our little armies or our little tools. It's to empower them that they become the future of Sunni politics.
All right, now, on the Syrian civil war, I've been meaning to ask you this for a couple of years now. You're most famous, if I can sum it up, and I hope I won't oversimplify it so simple that it's not true anymore, but basically your thesis, as you've shown in your work, is that foreign occupation, and the more different the civilization, the worse off you are, but foreign mm-hmm. occupation is the single leading cause of suicide terrorism, particularly in the world. And you've shown, obviously, like through the Tamil Tigers, that it's not necessarily wrapped up in Islam whatsoever, and these kind of arguments. But I wonder about how you categorize all the al-Nusra and Islamic State fighters, many of them Syrians, who have died and killed in suicide attacks in the Syrian civil war. Are they under foreign occupation?
Yep. There are two types of an occupation. One, an external, where there's a foreign community that's traveling across a border, say, the Americans into Afghanistan or the Americans into Iraq. There's a second kind of occupation where there is an internal government from one community that is foreign to a minority in its own state. That is, it's fundamentally different. And that internal occupation is what characterized Sri Lanka. where there's a single state called Sri Lanka, and the Sinhalese government, who are Buddhists, were occupying the Tamil Tigers that were Hindu.
Right.
That is an internal occupation. It's not coming from afar. It's happening internally, and you're getting suicide terrorism under the same basic conditions, whether it's an internal occupation or a external occupation.
So it doesn't matter if they're from the adjacent territory right there next door to you. It's the difference in the culture, in the society, and the beliefs.
It's the difference in the culture. And in the case of Syria, you have an Alawite government, which is Shia, occupying the Sunni. And in the case of Iraq now, you have a Shia government in Baghdad occupying the Sunni. So who's doing the suicide attack? They're the Sunni.
Right.
That's what's happening.
All right, but now...
And it's because of the religious... It's because of the difference, the social distance, and it's because these two different communities are very far apart when it comes to ways of life.
Mm-hmm. But now, what about all the kooks from Libya and Saudi Arabia and other countries in the Middle East who travel to Syria, even including Americans, who travel to Syria and then become suicide bombers?
You're right. They are not national. They're not internal. They are transnational. And in the studies where we can truly count, it turns out that somewhere between 10% and a third of the fighters that are fighting against an occupation are not coming from internally to the country. They're coming transnational from outside. But they, too, even though they're transnational, are motivated by the motive to defend the local minority against the occupation. What's driving them, a good example, let's just pick ISIS. Some of your listeners may be able to go to YouTube, and there probably still is the Canadian ISIS video of the Canadian from June 2014. This is about a 10-minute video, and if people haven't watched it, they should watch it, because you'll see that there's a Canadian who leaves Canada and goes to Syria, and he goes to Syria to die to defend the Sunnis, who he believes are under Shia occupation from the Alawite government. So it's true, he's coming from Canada, but it's also the same motive.
Right. And so then, another important example here, of course, is the 9/11 hijackers, who I guess many of them were from Egypt, and one was even, let's see, one was from Yemen, one was Lebanese. What about them? Are they an aberration?
Yeah. 19 hijackers caused 9/11. 15 of them came from Saudi Arabia, one from the UAE. So those 16 and the Arabian Peninsula, which includes Saudi Arabia and the UAE, had enormous American military presence at the time. And the 9/11 hijackers from Saudi Arabia made martyr videos. And their martyr videos, which I'm afraid your audience won't be able to find on YouTube. So I do have these, and I show them when I give my public talk, but they are not readily available. But their martyr videos lay out that they are doing 9/11 because of the occupation of the Arabian Peninsula by the American military, which they see as distorting their way of life. It's true. There were three. Mohammed Atta was an Egyptian. So there are not every single one of the 9/11 hijackers. What was from Saudi Arabia, but the overwhelming majority were. Mm-hmm. And so what I would say is that it's a pretty close fit.
Right. Well, and by the way, and I didn't really sum this up for people very well in the introduction. I should have. Again, everybody, it's Robert A. Pape from the University of Chicago, and he studied every suicide attack in the world since 1980. So when he says, you know, the data this and the data that, he means all of it. No, really, all of it. He's done that work with the help of his students, I'm sure. And now, so Same thing for the, is it just the exact same kind of a logic going on with the Canadian attackers, apparently, in the last week here?
Well, if you look, it looks like the individual who did the attack in Ottawa is doing it precisely because the Canadian government denied his passport application to go to Syria to fight for ISIS. So the more that we are learning about what happened in the Ottawa attack, the more it is about an individual wanting to go to defend the community in Syria that he believes is under great threat. And the Canadians were simply denying him the opportunity to do that by preventing his passport application from going forward. It will take, so when I study suicide attacks, I'm not just studying the moment they occur. I collect with my research team information about every suicide attack that has occurred since the early 1980s, even long after they've occurred. Sometimes the best information comes a week or two afterwards when we get much more clarity about the motive. And what we're seeing with the Canadian case is, as time goes on, we are getting deeper understanding of the motive, and it is fitting this pattern of an individual wanting desperately to fight for a community he sees as under threat.
Mm-hmm. And did you see here, or maybe you can verify this even, it's reported in the Globe and Mail that the shooter's father in the second attack fought on America and the West side in the war in Libya in 2011. Against Gaddafi.
I can't really verify. I cannot verify that. So I'm not able to confirm that at the moment. But so what we do at the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism is we have an online database, which your listeners can go to. And it's free, and it's up to date within a month. So it's not up to date to the day, but we usually need a month to try to get most of the evidence on the attacks that occurred in the past 30 days.
And what's the site again,
Mark? The Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism. Mm-hmm. It has the best data in the world on suicide attacks. The government uses this database. It's very... And you'll see that when your listeners go to the database, they don't just search a database and get data. They can keep drilling down under the, quote, view source, and they will be able to get the actual textual information verifying all the information. So, that Scott, when you ask me, can we verify X or verify Y, we don't just assert it. We put the actual verified textual references in complete text on the web for free, so that you don't have to just trust me about what I'm saying. But we're about 1 month always out of date, because it takes about a month to really let the dust settle, so to speak. Otherwise, we'd be changing the database every day.
Right. Yeah, no, that's fair. And also, you're doing the kind of in-depth work that it's better that you take your time.
And we have a research team that what we're doing is collecting corroborated. So when you say we have rules for what counts as independent sources. So every bit of data requires a minimum of two independent sources. And again, your listeners could actually go to the website, and there's a 9-page manual that explains in detail how we go about this. Which is why it's become the go-to place for really tracking suicide attacks. Mm-hmm.
And one more thing here real quick, and I'm sorry we're going to go a little bit over time here, but one last question if you have a moment. There was a guy named Dan Dresner who got in an argument with Greenwald. He did not mischaracterize what Greenwald wrote as any kind of apology, but he still criticized him, only fairly. But what he said was... Mm-hmm. You know, something along the lines of, well, what about the democracies? If how come they attack us, but they don't attack Iran and they don't attack China? It must be because they hate what's good about us, that kind of thing. And I was wondering if you could speak to that. Why terrorists don't bother attacking China? And for that matter, why don't the bin Ladenites attack Iran all day?
So first of all, it is what Dan Dresner is saying is generally true. That is that especially suicide terrorism has been directed against states that hold elections. Some of those elections are not as free and fair as others, but they hold, many of them hold meaningful elections. And the reason is because suicide attacks are increasing costs, and they're trying to get governments to change their policy by increasing costs. And some of the most brutal dictatorships in the world aren't sensitive to cost. Like Saddam Hussein would not have been sensitive to cost. However, what's been happening in the last few years, and this is true in Iran, and this is even true in China, and it's certainly true in Syria, is that suicide terrorism is happening more and more in what you might think of as the more moderate authoritarian regime. Not the most brutal regime. Not again. This, I'm not saying that Saddam Hussein's regime would have been susceptible to this. But if you go to the CPOST database, you'll be able to track the number, the increasing number of suicide attacks in Iran, in China, and of course in Syria. And I've been to China 8 times in the last 2 years, talking about terrorism rising in China. And there have been a handful of suicide attacks, and it is, in fact, creating an enormous public pressure on the government because the public is afraid, and the government is starting to respond, giving the Uyghurs basically more concessions.
So, in other words, the degree to which they're responsive is the degree to which the terrorists bother butting their head up against the brick wall there.
That's exactly right. These are groups that are trying to get concessions from governments that have very few alternative means. So that doesn't mean they're always going to get their maximum demands. It doesn't mean they'll even get any demands all the time. But if they can get demands a third of the time, progress further demands, say, a quarter of the time, a third of the time, that encourages them to keep trying. And that's what you're seeing in Iran. But especially, I would just say, look at the data set, the database that I'm talking about, the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism, and just see the increasing number in the last few years of suicide attacks in China and Iran.
All right. Well, with that, I will let you go and catch your flight. But I sure do appreciate your time on this layover, Robert.
I'm glad we're able to do it. Thanks so much for having me on, Scott.
Good to talk to you again. That's Robert A. Pape, everybody. He's a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. And, yeah, this web address is kind of too complicated for you to memorize, but just Google up the Suicide Attack Database, the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism, the Chicago Project on Security and Terrorism. And the books are, what is it? The first one is Dying to Win, the Strategic Logic of Suicide Terrorism, and then the second one is Cutting the Fuse, and we'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and yeah, I blew through this break, and I blew through that other break, and I kept interviewing Robert Pape because, well, he's got important stuff to say. I don't listen to him too good, so I had to ask him the same thing a couple times. No, maybe. Anyway, it's my show. We can do calls if you guys want. The phone number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Paste that into the chat room here. The chat room is scotthorton.org/chat. You want to join up the chat room? I have one comment here from email. I do not know if he's listening live, but the question is, my entire college class thinks the U.S. does not torture terrorists. My professors said they do, but don't take credit for it. Well, Yeah. In other words, since the Bush years, they focused more on rendition to other countries rather than doing it themselves. But then again, as Jeremy Scahill reported in The Nation, the CIA helps and the special forces help oversee a torture dungeon beneath Mogadishu. I'm pretty sure that counts. And I'll direct you, most importantly, to Jeff Kay at Fire Dog Lake. He's a real expert in this, and he's written at length about what's called Appendix M to the Army Field Manual. Here's the story, what happened. After the Abu Ghraib scandal, Copper Green, Taguba report, etc., etc., John McCain said, hey man, we're going to pass this Detainee Treatment Act. And it's going to say that the CIA and the military have to treat detainees just like it says in the Army Field Manual. Simple as that. And then Dick Cheney said, no, leave the CIA out. They should still be able to torture people and not be bound by the Army Field Manual. And so McCain said, okay, and took the CIA out and said, okay, well, at least from now on, the military will be bound by the Army Field Manual. And then first he compromised and agreed, we'll rewrite the manual. Then they passed it. Then they rewrote the manual. And in Appendix M, it allows for not the worst abuses of the Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, George Tenet era, but still pretty bad stuff. Temperature manipulation, which can mean severe discomfort, like maybe hypothermia. Maybe pretty damn miserable anyway. Sleep deprivation, which is torture. You ever been tired as hell because you had to stay up to do something, but still there wasn't really a gun to your head? How about no, if really they were making you stay awake for a week? Yeah. And they get away with all kinds of blue bloody murder. And yes, they still have a rendition program, just like Professor says, where many times there's really no reason to believe, in fact, that any person that is abducted by the CIA or the military and transported hither and yon to whatever country to be prosecuted or tortured or murdered or disappeared or whatever it is, that they're even from that country necessarily. Just like in the Bush era when, you know, God knows who was going to Syria to be tortured back when Assad was a partner in the war on terrorism not so long ago. Right now, the Bagram prison in Afghanistan is full of a bunch of people who are outside the law because they're on this foreign territory, which is some kind of so-called battlefield, even though the war was won 13 years ago. And anyway, there are people from all over the world being held at Bagram, people who've never been to Afghanistan before except in custody at Bagram. And God knows where else. So the way the question was worded was a little vague. I would have asked, you mean right now in Obama years as opposed to during Bush years? Then it's still wrong that there's no torture. There's torture plenty. I don't think it's nearly as bad as the Bush regime. But then again, Barack Obama right now, they're leaking this. They put trial balloons in the newspaper about this. They want to go with Bush's interpretation of the laws enforcing the anti-torture treaty. And exempt himself and his administration from it. Which, of course, the treaty says you can't do. And the excuse of necessity is never good enough. And this is a bill that, I forget who I'm paraphrasing here, but it's just a simple fact. I read it the other day that the anti-torture treaty was conceived of and pushed by the Ronald Reagan administration to the world. It was America's treaty. And Reagan told the world, well, if you're not horrible bastards, then sign the anti-torture treaty then. And made everybody sign it. And then it was the Bush senior administration that actually signed the treaty and had it ratified by the Senate. And then it was the Bill Clinton administration I think, actually, in Newt Gingrich years with a Republican Congress who passed the federal laws implementing the treaty. This is a bipartisan, tri-presidential, whatever the hell. Can you do that? Tri-presidential. I was going to try thri, but I guess not. Three presidents made these laws happen. Junior and Obama. Obama agrees with Junior. Forget it. We can torture who we want. There's no law. This is America, USA, USA, and all that. And I guess you prefer the other side win, don't you? And blah, blah. Amazing. All right. So there's your answer. Yes, America still tortures. They legalize it. And Obama right now, and you can read it in the Washington Post, Obama right now is, and there's actually debate going on about this in some legal circles. Certainly you can read it at Marcy Wheeler. Whoa. At Marcy Wheeler's blog. That they're working on David Addington level evasions around restrictions on torture. I don't know. That Barack Obama, he sure is a lousy president. If it was me, I wouldn't care what they threaten. I would just undo them all. Oh, well. So, yeah, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. If you want to call in, it's 512-271-4836. We're about to go out to this break. We'll take your calls after that if you want. Let me mention, I guess real quick, yeah, I don't want to talk about stupid Ebola. You don't want to hear about stupid Ebola. Here's what I'll tell you real quick before the break. So I'm watching Sean Hannity last night. This is my new thing. I'm back to Fox News, man. I got to stick with what the majority of the people are watching, and which is also the worst. Oh, my God, it's so horrible. And so I'm watching Hannity, and I'm watching their coverage of the lone wolf attacks up in Canada and all this, and I'm recognizing again what I already know. I won't call it realizing, but I was reminded, let's say, last night, that, wow, they're never, ever, ever going to tell the truth. They couldn't possibly. In fact, Sean Hannity is the perfect poster boy for all of American introspection. We ain't got none, and certainly not on TV. Can you imagine the conversation on Fox News? Even in Democratic times, with a Democratic president. Could you get Hannity? Maybe if you framed it that way. Sean Hannity, you know, the worst thing about Barack Obama is that with his foreign policies, he's created all this resentment against America. People want to attack us because of these occupations. I don't even think then. Could you ever get these people to recognize what Robert Pape says? Sorry about your feelings, but hey, man. America started the terror war. Terrorism is a reaction to the empire, not the other way around. Come on. They're never going to tell you the truth. Not never. Not in 50 more years of this. 100.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, guys. So, I got a lot of stuff to cover. Let me just say it all out loud. At least I'll get it out of the way. Malala has, again, criticized Barack Obama for killing innocent people and creating a terrorist problem, making the one we already got worse. Her fellow Nobel Peace Prize winner, Barack Obama. How in the world they gave that thing to him? They thought it was going to influence him to be less belligerent. Well, come on. He's an American president. His job is letting blood. President's going to let. That's his thing. Anyway. So there's that. I like her, man. She told him that to his face in the Oval Office. You know that? They don't talk about that on too much. In fact, remember our friend Peter Hart was on the show earlier? He has a whole write-up on that.
at fairness and accuracy in reporting. Wow, wouldn't it be cool to have like a staff and some help? He's got a whole write-up on that at fairness and accuracy in reporting about how this heroic girl who stood up to the Taliban and influences other little girls to want to learn to read and be educated and all they can be. Victimized by the Taliban, heroically rises above, and then, you know, the Western governments try to usurp her as much as they can. She's got a real independent spirit, dude. You got to hand it to her. She didn't let people put words in her mouth or anything like that. She goes to the White House, and she told Obama to his face in the Oval Office, your drone attacks kill innocent people, and they create new terrorists because they kill innocent people. Do you understand? I mean, Mr. President? She's very nice about it, I'm sure. Very polite. And so now here she is saying it again. It's the picture article today on antiwar.com if you want to read all about it. NBC News finally covered it. Oh, that was what I was going to say about FAIR. Sorry, my FAIR tangent. FAIR did a write-up about how she said this stuff to the president, and the American media didn't cover it for weeks and weeks. And then when they finally did, it was mentioned like once. Quiet here. You could have read it in The Guardian. You could read it if you're an online news junkie. If you're just waiting around for the top of the hour news brief or for the NBC nightly news to explain to you that, yeah, this girl Malala, who's always telling killers to stop killing people, said the same thing to the president of the United States today. Not a different thing. The same thing she says to the Taliban all the time. Stop killing people. Peace Prize winner Malala Yousafzai to Obama. Stop arming the world, she says this time. You could change the world if only you would send books instead of guns to other countries, she said. I like that. So the guy interviewing her asks, how did the president respond to that? She says his response was pretty political. In other words, yeah, 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 little girl, shut up. Leave me alone. You can take your Nobel Peace Prize and shove it. Those things are worth nothing. Pretty sure that's a direct quote from the dear leader. Maybe not. All right, so in other news, of course, there's the thing in Canada. In the space of 4 days, you got 2 attacks, both of them by Muslim converts. Both of them apparently wanted to leave the country and couldn't get out of the country. One wanted to go to Libya. The other wanted to go to Syria to fight. And were kept home. I propose a new policy. Let these kooks leave. Send them to Syria. Send them to the Islamic State. Where they're almost sure to be killed. But then certainly never let them back in. But don't keep them here. They've already... express their determination to commit the highest treason and go join up Al-Qaeda in a war, then let them go and get shot by all means. I don't think you can charge them with treason just for wanting to go. But just let them go and then leave them there. I give a hell what happens to you after you go fight for the Islamic State. I'm going to laugh my ass off when they strap a suicide belt around you. Oh, you don't even speak a word Arabic, huh? You know how to drive a truck? Here's a truck full of explosives. Go drive it toward that thing. Anyway, the real point is that this is part of just this thing going on for so long now. I mean, it was unthinkable that anyone would side with the enemy in this thing after September 11th. But now that it's 13 years later, and now that the Republicans and the Democrats have proven that their morality is in no way superior to the morality of bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri and Omar Baku al-Baghdadi, whatever his real name is, it's pretty easy to think that someone who is a Muslim, and especially somebody who is a young and probably pretty stupid, convert, full of piss and vinegar and wanting something to believe in and something to go and fight for. It's just a numbers game, right? A certain percentage, a very small percentage of these kooks are going to actually just go and act this thing out. You know, we've laughed on this show in the past about
young Americans who were prosecuted, arrested by the FBI, prosecuted for wanting to go and fight with the Mujahideen in Syria, when I thought, hey, they were the good guys this whole time. One of them, the father, said, no, he was recruited by the CIA to go. FBI, call CIA. They'll tell you. You know, which may or may not have been true, but it was plausible enough at the time, right? It bared further looking into. We're talking about back in 2012 or maybe early 2013, something like that, you know? They get it all very confused. And then, of course, with any kind of high-profile crazy crime, then you got the copycats. So one guy hits a couple soldiers with his car, and another guy says, well, you know, I'm going to go ahead and try to take out the parliament. What am I waiting for? Then another guy, now yesterday, goes and attacks NYPD on the street with a hatchet. Did you see the footage of that? The guy running up and raring up to swing that hatchet at the cops. Holy crap, got one in the head, the other in the arm, and then they shot him. And they shot an innocent woman in the back, by the way. You know, because the cops can't even defend themselves without, you know, almost at least killing an innocent person. They may have killed her. I mean, the last I heard, they weren't saying what her status was. At first they said she's okay. Now they're not saying. Shot some innocent bystander in the back, the cops did. Which, you know, I don't know. Some guy's coming at you with a hatchet. You might not be that good of a shot. All of a sudden, taken by surprise. Hatchet-wielding guy. They might owe her a real big apology. You know. You know, a good straight kick to the chest can do a lot of good, though, man. You'd be surprised. You can keep somebody at leg's length with one of those things. Although, you might get your leg chopped off. It's better than shooting an innocent person, though, you know, if you can get a little distance and then pick your target well. Anyway. The point is, it's the terror war's fault. I mean, these guys, can you even call this real jihadi terrorism when these guys are kooks, dude? Their friend, this guy, the shooter in Ottawa, they say his friend says the devils have been following him around. You know, demons have been following him around everywhere he goes or whatever. Maybe he was a schizophrenic, right? At least he's a real loser, not in touch with much of reality anyway, because he hadn't been educated much in it. He's kind of lost, just joined up. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Well, a friend sends me this link. Ottawa shooter was a crackhead who tried to rob McDonald's with a stick. Hey, man, why are you trying to rob my McDonald's with a stick? He wanted to go to jail so he'd have a few days with the inability to score some crack so maybe he could get his head together a little bit. So there you go. That's the jihadi lone wolf attacker. Local crackhead. Anyway. Terrorism is a lot more fun. Although, I don't know, the guy that they say he sat there in his car for 2 hours before he hit a couple of soldiers, letting countless regular civilians walk by the couple of days before. That sounds pretty politically motivated. They say there's no connection between them. I don't know. And then the guy that did the hatchet job in New York, I don't know. Dude's brown with a beard. That's all I know about it. I guess everybody is, investigating his Facebook page. Oh, I guess they're already saying, oh, yeah, he was a Muslim convert too, right? Three of these things. One and a half, two and a half. It's interesting. And, you know, with the copycat thing, might be in for some more. And not like it does any good to say or anything, but kind of been warning about this all along. It's not too hard to imagine how some of these people who identify on with the other side, instead of traveling to Somalia or traveling to Syria to go fight, could just stay here. And it doesn't take much to hit a soft target, does it? And the point is to stop the war. As Robert Pape says, I'd put the words in his mouth, kind of, but he sure didn't argue with me. And anyway, it is his point, really. The U.S. started it. The U.S. helped support the Mujahideen in the 1980s, and then the Americans angered the Mujahideen by occupying the Arabian Peninsula, using the bases there to bomb and blockade the Iraqis to death, as well as supporting the Israelis, not in their very existence, but in their permanent occupations of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and southern Lebanon. Golan Heights, too. And so, that's what caused it all in the first place. Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush before him. And that's what led to the excuse for, you know, everyone pretending. I remember laughing out loud on, say, September 12th or 13th, 2001, just after the attack, and one of these kooks on TV news said, "Wow, the terrorists have awakened a sleeping giant." I can't even say it now without laughing. 13 years later, sleeping giant? That was in 1941, and it was alive then, pal. Sleeping nothing. You got your wrong monster analogy there, you know, or your wrong giant analogy. I think you know need to go with, what's his name in the Lilliputians? Who's the guy with the Lilliputians? Help me out, guys, with the stories there, chat room. Is that Gulliver? Gets tied down by the Lilliputians? He'd been awakened long ago, then he went back to sleep, and then he woke up and he was tied down. He was sleepwalking into overextension there. Found himself bogged down on foreign territory kind of thing. Sound familiar? All right. Nidal Hassan. You know, Sean Hannity is right that it is absolutely absurd that Nidal Hassan's attack at Fort Hood is termed workplace violence. Like he just went postal because he hates working at his crappy government job. He attacked guys who were deploying out to Afghanistan. He picked his targets carefully. And he said himself, his point was, it was an act of war. You could quibble over whether it's terrorism or not. They're not civilians. They're volunteers in the military. They were deploying out to Afghanistan. They were arguably within the realm of quote-unquote legitimate targets as far as wars go. So, but then again, he snuck up on them and they were all unarmed and he blasted them. But that's the American way, right? So, I don't know. But, you know, it was an act of war in the terrorist war is what it was. And the fact that he was emailing back and forth with Anwar al-Awlaki saying, "Think I should do it?" And all of this is proof enough that he was a self-recruited lone wolf al-Qaeda terrorist. And he was an officer in the military and had access to a military base. And he hit him in a soft target. And then they call that workplace violence and play it down for democratic politics reasons. Because they don't want to talk about, well, first of all, oh, gee, you mean killing Osama didn't eradicate the jihadi problem that policy keeps spreading all around the world? And they didn't want to talk about, you know, they didn't want anyone to hear what this guy's saying about why he did it. Not that anyone would take his side and think that he was justified in doing it. No American would take his side and think he was justified, but they don't even want us to understand. They want to say, oh, he just cracked because he couldn't take the pressure at work. And so, you know, once you're a crazy person, you do crazy person stuff. And that does a disservice to all of our security when they're not being honest about who the enemy is and what they're all about. It's the same thing as when they blame the Khobar Towers attack on Iran and Saudi Hezbollah. What? Would you shut up, you stupid liars, back in history 20 years ago? 18? It was Osama did the Khobar Towers. Gareth Porter's got the goods on it, of course. But by allowing the story to go the other way, it changed the course of history. What might have been done about Osama bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed way back then, 5 years before the September 11th attacks. You never know what the costs of these omissions in honesty are, but usually you can look back and go, oh, look how the lie led to the bad thing. Usually you can find a bad thing and look back and find the lie that led to it, too. Speaking of which, I got Rand Paul to talk about in the next segment, don't I? Let me make sure I wrap up every other thing before I get to ranting about Rand. There's an article today about the fissure between Obama and Netanyahu. And once again, I just like to say, I think it's because Netanyahu is a white supremacist. And to him, Obama is nothing but an N-word. And he just cannot stand to be talked down to by, after all, the leader of the world empire, when he's just the prime minister of the tiny little satellite state. And he just can't stand it because he's a bigot. And so you could see why, from Obama's point of view, well, really, I don't like you that much either. You're damn right my father was African, what? Or something along those lines, right? Isn't that what you would say? He was a better man than you, too. How do you like that? You know, something like that. So I think this is at the core of their disagreement. It's not like Obama has ever really posed a threat to Netanyahu's policy toward Iran or toward Palestine, really, right? Or I don't know, maybe toward Iran policy lately. But only in the last year, not before then. So there's a lot more to this than that. And I think it's that Netanyahu is a racist and Netanyahu hates black people and Obama is black. So you could see right there how the leader of the Jewish KKK doesn't take too well to a black man telling him what's supposed to be the deal or not. But, you know, that's just me. Actually, no, I don't think that is. I think there's a lot of you probably nodding your head and saying, yeah, you know, I think that's about right. It's obvious enough. And I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to cover the ISIS war enough. I guess it'll come up in context of the Rand Paul rant coming up in a second. There's a great new article by Julian Assange. We'll be spotlighting it on antiwar.com over the weekend about Google. I really want you to read it. It's in Newsweek by WikiLeaks' Julian Assange. It's really good for looking at, so yeah. And we'll be back to wrap up the show right after this. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. By the way, you read that article about Obama and Netanyahu not getting along. You just get a little ways into it, and you see it's all about Israel giving American technology. Oh, selling American technology to China. And so it's kind of a professional problem as well, you see there. America is Israel's ally. They don't give a damn about us at all. So that's important. Man, I'm sorry. I didn't even get a chance to finish reading this article. It's by Robert Mary, and I don't know why they called it Petraeus to the Rescue. I got them confused. General Dempsey to the Rescue. How America's top military leader dragged Obama back into Iraq. Well, it's a horror story. Rescue, nothing. To the rescue of the Pentagon, to the rescue of Lockheed and Raytheon and General Dynamics, a bunch of admirals and a bunch of, you know, generals and all of their lackeys and all the banks that service their accounts. But this is supposed to accomplish what? I mean, I let Robert Pape slide because, hey, he's no libertarian. That ain't why he's here. And he was talking about, you know, the most rational, you know, policy going forward on the ground there. I mean, he seems to think that Obama is anywhere near approaching it. But I just don't see it. What he described as The most rational approach sounds completely far-fetched compared to what's within the realm of political reality. That's what I kept trying to get back to that he kept ignoring. It's the Republicans calling Obama a wimp when Baghdadi's still in power there in Mosul a year from now, giving a speech from his balcony, celebrating the fact that he ain't been got yet. Anyway, damn war, stupid war. I don't know whether I have a KPFK show. I don't know. They're either on Fundrive still or they're not. If I have a show this Sunday, it'll be about the Iraq War. I'll get somebody on and talk about this stuff. Spend more time on it. I guess we did get to talk about the war with Pape today, at least, so that's good. I had more of my own stuff to say. But now I got to talk about Rand Paul. So Rand Paul gave a speech to the National Interest Foundation, which is not the same thing as the Council for the National Interest. I'll have you know. And it drives me mad. But then again, that's the game he's playing. He's splitting the difference. He's Hegel, and I'm the dialectic. He wants to make me mad, and he wants to make the hawks mad, and then he wants to tell the people, see, I'm reasonable. The libertarians don't like me because I'm just not pure enough, and the hawks don't like me because I'm just too damn reasonable. And then people will say, okay, that's good enough for us. That's his bet. So, you know, Steve C., the old commenter, used to joke that really, oh, wink, wink, we all know you're serving Rand as his loyal opposition and all of this kind of thing, which he was being sarcastic and messing with me, of course. But in effect, I guess, to a degree, that's true. This thing just drives me mad, and I'll just go through why real quick. First of all, he says that Russia's trying to recreate the Soviet Union, which is a horrible lie. That's not just a little rhetorical thing. That is such a huge lie. For him to just accept that and repeat that as the consensus for all serious people in New York and D.C., that is a real problem, man. And that's all I got to say about that for now because I'm in a hurry. But damn, dude, how could you do that? That is a lie. Incredibly dangerous lie. I mean, that is a Harry Truman level damned lie. But then here's the part that really drives me nuts for obvious reasons. Will they hate us if we are less present over there? Perhaps. But hatred for those outside the circle of, quote, accepted Islam exists above and beyond our history of intervention overseas, says Rand Paul. So, there are some fringe Islamists somewhere at all times who might mean us harm if they had the slightest ability to do anything about it in a normal time? Big deal. What does that have to do with anything? Again, Rand Paul blaming radical Islam for America's trouble with terrorists over there, when again, like every day, but today, especially with the help of Robert Pape, it's been explained a million times, and by his father most heroically and famously, in the face of, you know, people booing and hissing at him and catcalling him and mocking him, led by Giuliani the thug. It's, as he says in the case of Libya, American foreign policy that turned that place into a jihadist wonderland. Yeah? How about the Iraq War? You ever heard of that, Rand Paul? So here what he's doing is, first of all, he's throwing his father under the bus on his father's most important winning point. That, hey, man, it's... just chill out for a second. Yes, it's true, we started it. Oh, hold your emotions for just a second. Yes, we started it. Just because America's the evil empire doesn't mean that anyone who opposes us is, you know, the heroic rebel alliance. They're a bunch of evil civilian butchering monsters. Al-Qaeda, are you kidding me? Doesn't make them good guys. It just makes them the right-wing, reactionary, radical, fringe Islamists who do the attacking first. In their mind, on behalf of their fellow Muslims. Rand Paul knows that. You know, that YouTube's out there somewhere, because I've seen Rand Paul give a speech where he talks about this, the origins of the terrorist war against us, where just as well as his father, he cites Robert A. Pape. He cites Michael Scheuer. Hey, someone give a hot tip to Jennifer Rubin to have all of her lackeys and interns over at the Washington Post dig up the YouTube of Rand Paul talking about Robert A. Pape. I've looked for it. I can't find it, but I know I've seen it. Where Rand Paul is in 2007 and 8 defending his father's position on the origin of the terrorist war against us and then our war back, which really started on our end again. And so that just pisses me off. Oh, some anger is blowback, but some of it is, you know, their terrible religion. Yeah, who? How many people? 100 people? 200 people, like it was in the fall of 2001? Or a few thousand people, like it is now? And how many is that? A few thousand? Oh, it's their religion makes them do it, huh? Like Muhammad Atta, who spent all of his free time at the strip club? He wasn't mad because religion told him to be mad. He was mad because his fellow religionists were being murdered by America. He barely had to believe in it at all. He knew he was going to die. He wanted to go to the strip club. I mean, he was a Muslim, but he didn't have to be. That's an obvious key, again, to this entire lie that is about Muslim extremism. The more fundamentalist a believer in Islam you are, the more of a violent terrorist. It's just a stupid lie. How do they ever convince you to believe that? When their own story of Muhammad Atta and his buddies is that they're a bunch of hypocrites. Hanging out at the strip club, blowing all their Saudi donors' money in their free time. Anyway, then Rand Paul also says he wants to use air power to fight ISIS. He agrees with Obama on that. He supports the sanctions the U.S. and the EU put on Russia. He agrees with the measures taken at the NATO summit to increase military preparedness, especially increased European defense spending, which he'll try to spin later as saying, no, see, I'm trying to get the Europeans to carry more of the load. Yeah, how about breaking the alliance and just coming home from that? God forbid, huh? How about the slightest hint that NATO might ever be a relic and anything but a tool of American global hegemony and a guarantorship of so-called security? Seems like security's always on fire, but still. And so these things are making me madder than mad, because I love his father, man. And here, like, this is personal, where he's really disavowing his father's view on the origins of the war on terrorism and coming back to this, you know, this ridiculous Republican Party lie, this national security state lie that radical Islam makes them do it. And that's a real problem. But then, I will admit, I'll give credit to Rand Paul from a point of view, a certain one, and that is that, oh crap, and here I'm right out of time for it. Over at Vox, they say this is one of the most important foreign policy speeches in decades. That he says there's a limit to how much deficit spending that we should know really only go to war as an absolute last resort, even though, of course, he contradicts himself there on the ISIS question and a few other things. To them, this is a full-scale declaration of war against the rest of the Republicans, so... gotta hand it to him there. There's a fight coming.